everyone. This is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast. And we're Phyllis and I are in a beautiful home in San Francisco. We have some great guests. We have several guests here. Yes. Phyllis, why don't you introduce them?
It's very exciting tonight. We have in the flesh Bill Whetstone and Lindy Matula. We're in Lindy's house. And through Skype, we're connected to Danusha Niklovich.
And she's in Malibu, yes. Mm-hmm. And we're here today to discuss the Hallmark Research Institute and a book that all these people here published recently, World Hallmarks, Volume 1, Europe, 19th Century to 21st Centuries. And gold, silver, platinum, palladium hallmarks. And let's talk about how you all got together and decided to do this.
Well, I was teaching about hallmarks with the International Society of Appraisers. At the time I started teaching, I was president of the society, and Lindy and Danusha met me at a conference. About 9 years later, they came to a conference in New York where I was teaching, mm-hmm. and after I had given a lecture, they came up to me and said, "Why don't you write a book on hallmarks?" And I laughed and went, "No, but we can if the three of us write it together." Well, I really believe that it would be an insane amount of work. It would probably take a couple of years.
And now after the fact?
The two of them convinced me to do it. And 5 years later, we got the first edition done. And then now we are about to come out with our second edition. And very shortly, we're going to start in with our second volume, which mm-hmm. will be the Hallmarks of the Rest of the World. Mm-hmm. And then, very shortly after, because of Danusha's wonderful expertise, we are going to have a third volume, which will be a field guide compendium to Hallmarks.
Mm. And it took an insane amount of work, I'm guessing.
I actually remember when you were working on this, and your eyes are pretty bloodshot.
You looked crazy.
Yeah. We put in so many hours that it was insane. The first 2 years, I was writing and rewriting, and Danusha was doing formatting. And then when Lindy kicked in to start editing it, you could start to see that a focal point started to develop, that when Lindy started to edit, the book started to really come together from a literary point of view. Mm-hmm. Danusha did writing and formatting and layout and a tremendous amount of work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all the graphic work was under her. Mm-hmm. Mine's the writing. I mean, I knew this stuff for many, many years, but I could not have done this without them. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, first of all, to back up a little bit, I noticed when I went online that the books were sold out already. Who are the people that are using this book, and what would they use it for exactly?
Appraisers, gemologists, jewelry historians, jewelry collectors, period and antique jewelry dealers, customs and excise officers mm-hmm. all over the world mm-hmm. to prove where something was made and when it was made, mm. as well as anybody who's interested in doing research into precious metals.
Silver and watch.
Yeah, silver and silver collectors and dealers, watch dealers especially, to prove how old is your watch. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And just for the audience's sake, where do you three fall into these various categories?
Start out with Danusha. Where do you fall into this category? Are you an appraiser, or what do you do?
I'm Paradise and Associates of Los Angeles. Lindy's Paradise Associates San Francisco. We've been independent appraisers for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And seriously, we have been looking for a book like this forever. Uh-huh. And nobody's ever written it. So we decided, you know what? We got the people. We got the power. We can do it.
Wow, great.
Paradise Associates, and you guys primarily deal with jewelry.
Yeah. Jewelry, watches, gemstones.
Jewelry, watches, gemstones, right.
So are you two associates, Lindy?
We're independent offices, uh-huh. but we network.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Mm-hmm. Together. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And Bill, you're from Canada?
Yes, I used to live outside of Montreal and work in Montreal. Now I'm based out of Ottawa, but mm-hmm. I am hoping to transition to become a San Franciscan and
yes.
contribute to the California tax structure.
Excellent.
Yeah, we need it. We need you.
Welcome.
It's a poor state. We need every bit we can get. So, yes, I'll sign anything for you if you'd like. Get you over here. So,
I may hold you up to that.
No, count on me. So, in this, have you actually counted how many examples of hallmarks you have in this book?
You should ask that to Danusha because she probably knows the approximate number of illustrations and images.
Well, we've collected over 2,500 images that we have re-rendered from scratch to make them consistent in appearance. We've created them in an imagery that is unique and never before public. As far as what's contained in the book, I would have to say it's close to about 1,600 different hallmarks in the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an analytical index that's kind of a compression of imagery that you can reference in the back to, like a ready reference.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one is over 600.
Wow. Now, mm-hmm. how did you create the graphics from the actual objects where the hallmarks were?
As Bill had explained, we had started doing research years ago when we started to really get serious on this. Actually, I think my first emails to assay offices started in 2005, and that's when Bill and Lindy and I first started talking about doing this. I was looking at feasibility and how readily the assay offices would volunteer information. And I was surprised how much we could receive beforehand. And it all started with getting graphics from them as well as from publications and kind of researching, you know, whatever sources we could find on hallmarks.
Mm-hmm.
And starting off with graphics. Believe me, they were all sorts of conditions. That's why we had to make them uniform.
Okay. Now, the Hallmark Research Institute. Now, explain exactly what that is.
Well, Danusha, Lindy, and I set up the Hallmark Research Institute as a focal point for hallmarking as a means of collecting information and disseminating information so that anyone who's interested in a specific hallmark or a particular area has a place or a means to find out the information correctly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems that has happened is that there are a number of texts, some of them in my library up there, that do have some errors. And what we have tried to do is to set up a place that will eventually, when I move here, have all of my library and all of the relevant parts of the Institute's library in a ready place for research so that we can help identify not only trademarks, which are separate from hallmarks, but primarily hallmarks, but we're going to keep expanding in a number of areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our basic aim as an institute.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now what, for the novice that may be listening to this, can you quickly explain the difference between a trademark and a hallmark?
Okay, a hallmark is, as the term says, was originally the mark that was in English applied by Goldsmiths Hall in London, England. And the Goldsmiths Hall applied a mark on a piece of gold or silver to show that it had been assayed and met a specific standard mm-hmm. of fineness. This mark was actually used, the same mark, a royal mark of a lion passant, was used on both gold and silver
mm-hmm.
up until 1798 and then a little bit later. But it was used on both gold and silver items.
Mm-hmm.
So a hallmark becomes a assay office or a government applied mark that guarantees fineness. In the final entity, hallmarking is the ultimate consumer protection in precious metals because it's a guarantee that the item that you are buying is correctly marked. A trademark, also synonymous with the contemporary terms of a responsibility mark, a maker's mark, or a sponsor's mark, is a mark that is applied by the individual who is either the manufacturer or possibly the importer who is putting his mark on, as he is personally responsible for the item. So in North America, we only have trademarks, responsibility marks, or sponsors marks. We do not have hallmarks in Canada or the United States.
Was England regulating the purity of, say, the silver, and if were things confiscated if they did not meet the, like, say, the purity of silver on a piece?
Silver, from a very early period, we'll say 13th, 14th century, had to be sterling, which is 9.925 fine silver, 92.5% silver. Gold had to be 22 carat up until 1798. There were only two standards. Then in the late 1600s, they introduced what was called Britannia standard, which was a higher standard, which is 9.584 fine. As to your question about confiscation, if an item was under-caroted or below standard, normally what happened, it was destroyed. In other words, it would be put on an anvil and hit with a hammer, and the silver would be returned. The maker could also be fined for producing an item that was under standard. Normally, because you were a master, the first or second time they could be gentle about it, but if you were consistently under caroting or under the silver fineness of, let's say, sterling, you could be severely fined.
And how did they go about regularly testing or regularly policing what was produced?
They had a guild or something, right?
Well, the Goldsmiths' Hall is a guild. So there was a guild of goldsmiths and silversmiths. Okay, so they're all called goldsmiths in this period. The wardens or the officers of the hall were, somebody was either an assayer or they had appointed an assayer. Assaying is a very, very technical process, especially when you're doing cupellation. Cupellation is taking a small scraping or cutting of the silver and then doing a fire assay, which is very, very briefly, you bind up the silver that you cut in lead, you put it in a cupel, which is a bone ash crucible, you fire it, the lead draws the base metals into the cupel. The tiny little bead that is left over is then flattened out to make a ribbon, which is rolled to make a coronet, which is then immersed in hot acid. The hot acid dissolves any remaining base metals out of it, and any lead or anything. Then you take the weight of what's remaining versus the weight of the tiny little piece you started after, and you calculate, is it sterling or 22 carat or now 18 carat, 10 carat, whatever.
Sounds like
that's how they used to do it. But the ability in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century to weigh accurately to a thousandth of a unit, whether it's a gram or a penny weight, to be able to do this was really, really a masterful science and also an art.
Yeah, sounds very simple.
Right.
I think of I'm just going to ask you this question. You know how they always discover a new species of animal on the ocean floor or something like that, two or three every month or something? Do you discover new hallmarks that you didn't know existed?
Very rarely. We discovered, in doing some research, a secret Dutch hallmark that was not in a lot of items. At one point, the standards in the Netherlands changed. And the assay offices, because of certain older marks, were getting pieces that were being sent in for retesting with higher marks. And they kept seeing the same pieces being sent in for retesting. And because they had old marks, they were not required to pay a fee. So the assay office was spending money and getting no fees. So they invented this tiny little star mark with a little tiny circle in the center, which they applied secretly into the hidden designs of the piece of silver so that they wouldn't have to retest it. That's the kind of item that comes up. New hallmarks come out regularly because countries change their hallmarks. Countries modify
them. You're talking about modern day.
Modern day. But consistently all through history, governments, countries have changed their hallmarks or modified their hallmarks quite often in a regular cycle. Every 10, 20, 30 years, there's a new hallmark.
Interesting. And that's been going on for hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years.
Wow.
But this book, because it was written primarily for the jewelry trade, although it amply covers silver, because we wrote it for the industry where we do most of our business and obtain most of our livelihood and have had most of the wonderful times of our life for dealing in period and antique or modern contemporary jewelry, this was written for the jewelry trade.
I see.
Whether it's period and estate or modern.
Okay. Now, another thing, explain also to someone that may not have that much of a knowledge the different ways you look at hallmarks to get a region and date and letter and all that.
Well, hallmarks can either come out in one of several fashions, which we do cover: the style, the stripe, the standard, the shape, and of the hallmarks.
The 5S system.
And we have what we call the 5S system. And the 5S is, which the primary point, I think, has got to be the system. And the system means, whether you're looking at a marks, is how does the country use the marks? Some countries have, using another system that we have, that Danusha came up with, which is called ISIS, have a subsystem within this. And so a mark can be inclusive. For example, within the mark, the frame can indicate what the metal is. It could indicate whether the item is under or over a certain weight.
Excuse me, when you mean the frame surrounding the hallmark?
Yes, the
like
outline.
A shield or
yeah,
whatever
the
it is.
Outline,
yeah.
Whether it's a shovel shape, a club shape, a tonneau, which is like a barrel shape, that might indicate whether an item is under or over a certain weight.
I see, wow.
Okay, the elements within the mark will tell you generally where an item was made, what the fineness is, what the metal is, and possibly the period. Other systems have a group of marks, and within the group of marks, you can find out all of the independent information.
Right.
Each mark means something. And I'm just about that perfect. This is called a sequential system. Great Britain, Finland, Sweden all use a sequential system of marks. Modern Russia, modern Ukraine, and I mean modern by the last 100 years, use an inclusive system where everything is included in the mark. Modern Polish marks are an excellent example of an inclusive system.
For the audience, if you actually pick up this book, you can really understand the methodology that they developed, and it's very helpful.
One of the things that we did is that we set up 20 color pages at the beginning to explain how to look at marks. But even more fun, we set up several pages called Directions for Use. And we really...
How to use the book.
Basically. How to use the book and the terminology. So that before you get into the first chapter, you have an understanding of where you're going and what you're looking at. And
now, who edited this book for you? Did you have like an editor go through everything? You did. Lindy.
Lindy is the editor.
Wow.
And the unique thing about this book is that it is in English. Mm-hmm. Most books in our industry have been in French, and very little use to those of us who don't read or speak French.
Or do you German, have any in Russian, Italian?
Well, one thing that Martin and I were wondering about before we started this interview was, well, we were discussing, we always like talking about fakes.
Yes.
And
that's one of my favorite subjects,
right,
because it's so interesting.
Love to hear
the
it.
Different ways. Now, in the podcast I did earlier with the gentleman Wayne Hilt, an early pewter, very interesting, he was telling me about stamped hallmarks that were transferred onto another piece, say a real important hallmark of a real important maker, transferred over to a piece that may look similar. And I wonder how often that is done in silver.
Well, there's going to be fakes and forgeries. Well, actually, they started years and centuries ago. They get better with time, but there's in place, especially with Russia. Russia has particular methods, as well as Poland, in which the shape outline of a mark can indicate the weight of a piece. And should you take, let's say, an item that was small hallmarked and put it onto a larger item, right away you can tell that it's a forged piece or it's been transposed onto another piece. Some of the hallmarks have little subtleties that nobody picks up on. Matter of fact, they don't even tell us what those subtleties are so that they can tell if it's an authentic hallmark from the assay office or not. So there's ways to tell, and we actually have done several sessions in which we explain some of the pieces and ways to look at hallmarked items as far as fakes and forgeries goes.
Now, does anyone ever use the old dies to, you know, to strike in fake hallmarks? Is that ever used that way, creating a die?
Well, the punch is that when they're out of use or no longer used by the assay office, they're destroyed. Yeah, we make copies, but they're never as good.
I see. Mm-hmm. And you can always just tell from the quality of the stamping.
Bill is shaking his head.
Yeah. What have you got
That's
to
not
say
good then? Radio, Bill. Don't shake your head. Okay.
No, there are individuals who have made fake hallmarks.
Mm-hmm.
The fake hallmarks that are done by striking an object are pretty bad. We just came back from Prague, the three of us, and we went to Geneva and Prague for the International Association of Assay Offices conference, of which we were graciously admitted to and given seats at the international table. But in Prague, the assay office showed us samples of fakes.
Oh, really?
The die-struck fakes are really bad.
Mm-hmm.
What is somewhat scary, and mostly for modern pieces, are the laser-inscribed hallmarks.
Really?
This is a potential problem.
Yeah, I could see that. Wow.
And this is why Danusha mentioned before, there are items within the hallmarks that are not revealed to the public.
Mm.
Very, very tiny little things in the hallmarks, so that in the event of a forgery, they can easily say, okay, or maybe difficultly say, this is a forgery, this is real.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, have you ever been on the fence about something when you see it? I mean, it happens to all of us. When we see something, well, boy, I think it's right, but something about it bothers me.
Yes.
Does that ever come up?
That happens quite regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But normally, if you go with your gut instinct,
mm-hmm.
if it bothers you, it's probably
right.
something that you shouldn't buy unless it is so cheap that you really can't make any mistake. I bought, and I know this is not good for radio, but I'm showing a small creamer that I have here that was, it's assayed correctly for the top two-thirds of the piece for Sweden 1743, but the base is much later and not hallmarked, which is incorrect for this piece. Mm. So I know the piece is not correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have a question. Lindy, I know you have experience on the more, I should say, the manufacturing side. You used to be goldsmith, is it hard to weld or to marry two pieces of metal that are not the same purity?
No.
No?
It's not. It's, I mean, you can find ways. There are forensic gemologists that will actually go down to the solder that is used in putting things together, and if it does not fit the time period of the solder of the 17th century, we know that it's a fake. There are some really... People go to great lengths to duplicate what they can for period pieces that a forensic gemologist can actually determine if it's authentic or not.
But it's possible that you could take something that was 950 silver purity and marry it to something that was 800 and it would look passable if you were good enough.
If it was good enough, you can put patinas on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard of different methods for acquiring patinas, from burying it in manure in your yard to putting it in your pocket with change.
Now, when silver gets high, now I saw this back in the 80s, people buy at auction and the first thing they do is melt it. You know, and it's a shame because I have a friend on the East Coast and he was telling me that there's a lot of places that are buying gold and silver and for melt value, and people are bringing in Georgian silver, 18th century silver that's getting melted down. It's kind of a shame. Do you see that a lot in your... And do you see a lot of pieces getting bought up for being melted down?
In this case, amongst the people that are buying a lot of scrap, there are intelligent dealers that before these items go to melt, generally try to pick through and pick out the good pieces and buy them. I remember in the 1980s going and visiting a dealer when silver was around $32 an ounce, and he wanted $40 an ounce for anything I picked out of the bucket. But I picked out a sugar caster that was made around 1720. I picked out a number of pieces. Was I happy to pay 25% over melt at the time? As an historical piece, yes. As in considering that probably 3 years earlier, I could have bought the piece when silver was $2 or $3 an ounce. I could have bought it for $20 an ounce. I wasn't pleased to pay 40, but I was pleased to rescue the best English sugar caster that I had ever seen.
Now, just to skip over to jewelry, you know, I think of most pieces of jewelry, I think of small areas that they would be stamped. So are we talking some of these hallmarks are really minute and you have to look with a high power magnification?
Yes. Generally, I mean, I keep normally with me, and I'm probably the exception, a 10 power loop, a 14, a 16, and a 20.
And you have all those loops with you?
Yes, all the time. and lights. No, I just do, because I use my 10-power loop to look at most things that are easy to see on a surface. I use the 14-power loop because it's a very small field and a tiny little loop to get inside of rings that are difficult.
Sure.
I use the 16 and the 20 to see things that are generally on an outside surface where I want to see specific detail so I can verify that I believe the mark is correct. But all that having been said, the key to it is to look always at the piece and where the marks are placed. On jewelry, the marks are small. They can be from possibly as small as a half a millimeter by three quarters of a millimeter up to 1 or 2 millimeters by 3 or 4 millimeters in size. Big marks are no problem. The little tiny marks are not necessarily always on the back. We have a wonderful brooch that a very special platinum mark that was only used between 1910 and 1912 in France. It's a little rectangular mark with a weevil, like a bug in it. It was only used for about a year and a half, but it's on the outside gallery of the piece. French makers of marks and the assay office hallmarks are generally found on the outsides of the rings, which is why they get damaged and lost. We normally think of all the marks being on the inside of the ring, on the back of a brooch, but not all countries do that.
Mm-hmm.
There are specific books that list where on, for example, especially with French pieces, where hundreds of different kinds of items, where the marks are required to be. The same with English silver. The marks on certain pieces must be on the bottom. On other pieces, they must be on the sides of the piece. They must be on the upper edge. They must be on the left. They must be on the right.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important that you understand where the marks are supposed to be located, because to go back to your previous question, you're talking about forgeries. Transpositions are here. And within the book that we have written, we do mention some of this, but we do not discuss every location for every country, because we were concentrating on the hallmarks, not necessarily the positioning of all the hallmarks.
Sure.
Within each country, there are some countries that have 300, 400, 500 page, even 750 page books just on the hallmarks of the one country, whereas we try to put it all together in about 400 pages to give you a basis of where to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had a friend that published a book on antiques, and he had a lot of people in his field, specific field, write him minor corrections. Has anyone done that since you published this?
Well, every chapter, or virtually every chapter in this book, has been sent to the assay office of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they have gone through and made recommendations or suggestions. Generally, they suggest an addition to mm-hmm. vet it for us.
And this was prior.
This was prior to publishing.
Prior to publishing, yes.
That was a smart move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we want to be correct.
Sure.
Okay. We do not want to have a book that has information. There are several other texts out there. And the worst thing you can do is see a footnote in a specific book that says, oh, this book has an error in it.
Yes.
You don't want to know that. There is one of the major books from that has on the front cover 10,000 corrections on it. That is a bar that I never want to exceed.
I don't think I'd necessarily put that on the front of my book.
Do you? Not a good selling point, maybe.
Hide that somewhere. Yes.
When is the next edition of this, the revised edition, coming out?
It's the second edition.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be out the end of February, first week's in March, I believe. Dinesh, is that correct?
End of February. We should be getting it from the printer. And by the time we start getting it out in distribution, we should be looking at the beginning of March. But end of February, beginning of March.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? So who's distributing this book overall?
We are.
You are distributing it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are the publisher.
Okay. Yeah.
And we have backed the production of this book for 5 years and the printing of it with our own labor and our own funds.
Wow. Now, just for our listeners, I will have the link up on our website to steer you to where this book is. So you want to go to our website, antiqueauctionpodcast.com, and under the link of this podcast, you will see the link to this book. Now, is it, maybe I'm naive by saying this, but Amazon or any type of book dealer, I mean, can you find it anywhere out there, or is it only through your website?
No, the book is handled by several independent book dealers. Will be handled by at least one or more of the major jewelry appraisal societies.
Mm-hmm.
The National Association of Jewelry Appraisers has been a primary source. There are several independent book dealers. The first edition, because it was very small, because we wanted to see what it looked like,
mm-hmm.
had limited circulation. We probably sold about half the edition privately, and quite surprisingly, we sold probably more copies in Australia and New Zealand than we did in Canada, which is right next door to us.
Mm.
Wow.
So there is a demand out there. the next edition, we really hope to have wider circulation and distribution, but we will always remain a primary source for the book if you want it directly from us. Mm-hmm. And if possible, if you want a signed book plate, we'll try to see that we can help you.
Sure. Now, also, you mentioned a research library you're working on. Is that something you may put together within the next few years?
I would hope that we will have it possibly by the end of the year mm-hmm. or the beginning of next year. The library that you see in our house, such as the ones in my desk that are just above where we're recording, and in our mm-hmm. library, plus the huge number of books that I have in storage in Canada, mm-hmm. I want to be able to bring them down here, set up a research library where on, you know, by appointment, serious mm-hmm. individuals can come in mm-hmm. to look up marks, whether they're hallmarks, and maybe we'll have a small trademark library, but people will be able to come in and use it mm-hmm. when we're in the office and working.
Mm-hmm.
It's
sure.
not going to be just wide open to the public,
sure.
but it will be for individuals who are doing serious research.
And that'll be here in San Francisco?
It'll be in San Francisco, mm-hmm. probably in the downtown region.
Though we have an extensive library in Malibu right now as well.
I see.
Yes.
And anyone is welcome to come onto our website, hallmarkresearchinstitute.org,
mm-hmm.
and inquire as to any marks that they might be investigating or researching. Send us photographs, images of different angles. We'll be happy to assist in discovering whatever we can for you.
And they can stop by the library in the future with the piece.
By appointment.
By appointment and consult with you.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
And, you're on your website is your email address. Is that right?
That's correct.
So you can get to these people if you'd like to.
And Bill and Danusha actually do lectures on hallmarks across the country. If you mm-hmm. have any organizations in your cities that are looking for something extraordinary and unusual that can feature two amazing hallmark researchers, they are really good.
Can you talk a little bit about import-export marks and how to decipher those, or when
sure.
should they
import marks
be looked
are,
for?
In import marks are applied on gold, silver, platinum, or palladium items that are coming into a country that regulates those standards. They are applied for two reasons. One, to show that the item meets the standard, and two, to collect taxes for the state. By the state, I mean the government of the country. An export item generally has limited or no taxes.
Mm.
So when you're exporting an item out of a country that puts on an export mark, such as France or the Netherlands, you don't pay taxes, but the item is not legal for sale in the country unless it has either a return mark that shows that the duty is paid or is remarked to allow it to be legally sold within the country.
I see.
And that's the difference between export and import.
Well, I guess we're at the end of the podcast. It's, wait, we have one more thing.
I'm going to say is that if you are ever going to send us images, please do the following. Take images of the whole piece, front, back, and sides. We need to see the construction of the item and the overall look, not just the images of the hallmarks.
Mm-hmm.
We need clear, relatively large size images. Trying to look on a computer screen at an image that's 2 millimeters by 2 millimeters that's pixelated is virtually impossible. Although, because we teach about shape and style, sometimes we can guess pretty accurately. But the better the image taken with macro techniques through a microscope, which is not particularly difficult, Danusha has taught many people how to do that, and she's exceptionally good. Lindy is a wonderful photographer when it comes to taking hallmarks. I'm not. The better the image, the easier for us to point you in the right direction. And while we have really good information on hallmarks, The number of makers who have marks in the world is in the multiple millions versus possibly in the thousands for Hallmarks.
Mm. Wow.
We do not have information on every maker from every country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who wants to donate a whole lot of books to us, we would be very happy to accept them.
Now, you just mentioned a few minutes ago that some of the buyers of your book were in Australia and New Zealand. Do they have a real active collecting culture there? Why did they have?
Well, they have especially a culture of having English Hallmarks. Australia and New Zealand were an English colony. There are things that come out of Asia. There are things that come out of the Middle East. A lot of Europeans have moved there, Germans, especially if you look in the wine trade. You know, the families that came and settled in the in Australia and New Zealand, there are a lot of Europeans. Mm-hmm. So therefore, there are Hallmarks. Mm-hmm. But we had orders from our book from all over Europe, from South Africa, from people in Asia, because there is nothing else like our book in English.
Well.
There just isn't. And that's why we wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we should end on this high note. What do you think?
Do you guys all have really poor vision?
I'm probably the only one that is very myopic.
Did you hear how many loops this guy carries?
I know. If you take anything away from this, carry like 8 loops and make sure all of your pants have pockets.
Pants have pockets. I love it. All right. So this is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gall.
Bill Whetstone.
Lindy Matula.
And Denise McLevish.
And we're all signing
off.
Wait, don't go away. I want to talk to you about how you can help us out. We love doing this show. We do it for free. However, we do have some expenses, and you can help us without even realizing you're doing it. And that is, if you're going to purchase something on Amazon, why not go to our website, www.antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see there's an Amazon search engine. You can search for your item there, and if you purchase it, we will receive a small fee. That'll help us carry on. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.